potentially even more often, and even make the meetings longer. So would an hour and a half or 2 hour meetings work? I mean, I can still get meetings scheduled that work for your schedules, but is that kind of an idea going to be okay?
Are we able to go outside of like working hours?
We
that would be my one
that.
Preference is
okay.
Like not having to flex time.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, if, are other people comfortable outside of work hours as well?
This time's good for me. If we're after like 3 o'clock, it's technically outside my work hours anyway. So like, okay. I could go later and have no issues. So
okay, and maybe if we look for a 4 o'clock time and go beyond 5, like you're not flexing the entire time,
yeah,
maybe,
that's
or something
easier.
Like that. So we'll, in scheduling the upcoming meetings, we'll look at some variety of times that might work for everybody.
Thank you.
So today, my hope is to get from you direction on if and how we might incorporate new legislative direction that we'll talk about in a couple of House bills that passed into the ongoing development code update process.
Would you need to do our call?
Oh yeah, thank
Sorry.
You.
So as we've reminded you, every meeting we just need to declare potential conflicts of interest if you own property or could be involved in developing residential property in Springfield.
Just to clarify, do we have to declare it if we just have a primary residence?
Yes.
So
because we're doing residential code amendments that affect residential property, and if you are a property owner of residential property, it could impact your financial.
So I do have a potential conflict of interest being my primary residence.
Yeah.
Potential conflict of interest being a realtor and a homeowner in Springfield.
I have no conflicts of interest.
So we're just going to have to do that every time. It should be short and sweet. And
okay. So with, and so I just mentioned, get direction from you. I'm going to go through the materials. Originally, we had anticipated, though, that the code update would be a policy-neutral implementation project and implement the existing policy structure we have in our comprehensive plan policies today. In looking at, and we haven't fully digested all of the new legislation, but we're anticipating some change of policy and whether or not we want to incorporate that new policy direction or what might become new policy direction into the code update, which would be a little bit of a shift from what we were operating under currently. I also want to point out on the agenda, I put a spot for public comment. So these meetings are open to the public. There's opportunity for this body to receive public comment throughout this process. We do have a comment card form. You have a copy of what we're providing. We'll provide this for each meeting. There's copies on the table over here. If somebody did show up, I'll let, we didn't really establish a chair or anything, I don't think, for this group. So we'll just deal with that as it comes. If people start showing up and wanting to comment, we'll figure out kind of the procedure for that. But just so we all know and understand that that's part of the process. I don't see anybody here today, so I think we're good. I did provide you another copy of the community engagement plan. This is the final adopted version. The original one that the Planning Commission and the City Council recommended approval for and the Planning Commission as the CCI did the approval of, is buried deep in your notebooks, I think, at this point. So we've put another one in there. Hopefully a little easier access. We can refer to that if we need to. So I'm going to jump in. What I've provided you today is a highlighted version of House Bill 2001 as enrolled and one as House Bill 2003 as enrolled. I did this highlighting myself, and it was a fairly quick and process of me trying to highlight what I think are some of the more key sections of the legislation that I'll talk about for a few minutes, and then we can have a discussion. If there were any questions at the outset, I can take those now, or I'm going to jump into just kind of going through some of these sections, if that's all right.
Mark, as you go through it, are you going to sort of link to how this might shift the project.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, so I'm going to start with House Bill 2001, and it's probably the bill that has, in my mind, some of the greater impacts to what would be the code update. This concept of middle housing, sometimes you'll hear the term missing middle or missing housing or missing middle housing. The legislation refers to it as just middle housing. And there's a definition there I've highlighted at the beginning. It includes duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, cottage clusters, and townhomes. The townhomes piece is actually a change we wrote in and provided testimony on to the legislature to get them to add townhomes. It was our thought that the other four types were primarily rental housing options. And other than if you condominiumized one of the plexes or the cottage clusters, that there wasn't really an ownership option of housing type. So the townhomes, we hoped, could also be an ownership opportunity housing type within the middle housing. So they did add that. That was something we feel good about that was changed in the legislation. So the real mandate, or in my mind, the biggest part of the mandate of this House Bill 2001 is the kind of halfway down the page, is subsection 2, and that's applicable to the city of Springfield. We have a population over 25,000. It says, it shall allow the development of, and then there's two pieces, sub A and sub B. I usually talk about B, the second one, first, because it just flows in my mind better, but I'll just go in the order it's presented here. So it says, city shall allow all middle housing types in areas, and so I'm going to highlight that word areas, zoned for residential, because that, in my mind, is a key distinction. And then it goes on. And then the second piece is that cities shall allow the development of, and B, a duplex on each lot or parcel. So that's different than areas. So I'm going to talk about B first. So basically, this is telling us on every single family home lot in the city, we have to allow a duplex. It doesn't mean we can't allow single-family homes. In fact, later on, it specifically says in here that you can continue to still allow single-family homes. It's just that you have to allow the option of doing a duplex on every lot that allows a single-family home. And I'll jump ahead a little bit. So at the end of the legislation, there's also language that prevents new CC&Rs in a subdivision from prohibiting duplexes. So if there's a new subdivision that comes in, they cannot create CC&Rs that says we do not want or will not allow duplexes in our subdivision.
Does this version also include where it overrides prior?
It doesn't. I don't think they can. It's at the very end.
You can override existing CC&Rs.
There was some discussion
with legislation.
Otherwise, you would still be able to allow communities to exclude people of racial minority status or religious minority status. Those are still on the books in a lot of places.
Well, those are constitutional issues, aren't they, rather than...
Right, but they've legislated those away as well.
Okay. There was discussion, I know Sophie attended the webinar of the OEPA discussion.
My understanding has always been that the state can override.
If you look at one of the questions I sent you the link to, there's a discussion about that. My understanding is they didn't go back and say existing CC&Rs can't be enforced.
I thought at some point they had that in there.
It was a topic point at some point, but I don't know if it made the final cut.
My understanding is if existing CC&Rs in place, those can continue to be enforced. So subdivisions that have a prohibition, or usually you'll see the CC&R that says one dwelling per lot
in
lots of subdivisions. So if existing, as of the date this became law or becomes law, those CC&Rs are in place, my understanding is that can continue to be enforced in those existing subdivisions.
But again, that's not by the city.
Right.
So,
it's a private contract.
We don't.
The legislation prevents
it. We might give
it.
Someone an FYI, this is there, but we're not going to not.
So it will be up to your neighbor, essentially, to take you to court.
Yeah.
Say.
Right.
And there's, in the case law, too, there's changed circumstances. So if there's a prohibition around, for example, having three cars, but for 10 years, three houses in the neighborhood have all parked three cars there all the time, and no one's ever called them on it, and a fourth neighbor starts doing it, that fourth neighbor's got a really good defense that it shouldn't be enforced against them because it's the neighborhood has changed.
So the whole duplex on every lot is, I would say, probably a concept we were considering as part of the code update process anyway. Whether or not we truly would write the code in a way that allowed it on every lot, I think would, I don't know if we would have gotten there. I think conceptually we've been pursuing that as a thought, that that's where we would possibly get to, or at least broaden it a lot more widely than it is today, which today it's limited towards a duplex on a corner lot, if the corner is large, if that lot's large enough, which is 6,000 square feet of a lot. So again, the second part then is the.
So I would assume the way that this is written, like if those ultra small lots, there's a size that you just physically can't fit a duplex. And
right.
You'd be like, yeah.
So a lot of it's going to be driven by our density mm-hmm. requirements. So primarily our low density residential zone, it's 6 to 14 units per acre. Developments have a very hard time. Well, let me say this. New development has a hard time even meeting our typically getting to our minimum 6 units per acre density for a new single family home subdivision. Getting to 14 units per acre, our maximum density for low density right now, with our code the way it is nearly impossible. So, but I guess the point is, based on size, like how big is the lot, would the maximum for a duplex be at 14 units per acre?
So if you took a duplex in sort of that scenario and sort of played it out for a new development and they wanted to build duplexes across, would they exceed the low density requirement? The maximum density for
lots?
Yeah.
I mean, so the lot size for, I think my memory, I've done the calculation, it's roughly around a 3,000 square foot lot that you would have to plat out if they were all single family homes to be right under the 14 units per acre. So say you platted out a bunch of 3,000 square foot lots and then put a duplex on each one,
mm-hmm.
then you'd basically be a double, like 28 units per acre. That's something that I'll get to here, but the next part is that the legislation gives us the ability to regulate siting and design standards. So, but I think the answer to your question is yes, it would exceed our maximum density for that zone if, say, an existing subdivision was near our maximum density already,
right.
anticipating single-family homes, and now they went and put duplexes on all of them.
Is that a conflict, then? Or a potential conflict between our maximum density and what this says?
Potentially, yeah. And I think we're looking for more, I mean, I think I'm looking for more guidance from DLDC about what that means to really allow it for every lot. Do we have the ability to then restrict lot? I mean, where's our ability to have meaningful density? Maybe we don't have the ability to have meaningful density, and that may be part of the intent of the bill. So part of the problem is that we're moving faster than the state probably is. Mark's probably going to get into.
Yeah, and I have some options for you as
sure.
to think about in giving us direction. But that is a question, is how does the density play into that? And again, we may come up with a minimum lot size for a duplex. We might still keep it at 6,000. And test that with the state to see it is, because the test is does it create an unreasonable cost or delay, if we put in siding standards in developing this middle housing.
Wouldn't the siding standards be like setback and FAR?
Right.
And
so in the webinar we sat in, was that last week? Is it Jason? Palmer Mason from DLCD. Mentioned lot size as a siting standard. So whether or not that passes the test or not, I don't know.
Yeah. That conflicts with my interpretation of every lot reasonably,
right.
because there can be duplexes that
I have a slideshow I've put together that's like, guess if this building is a duplex or a single family residence. You know, right. Like there are duplexes that can be identical in size to traditional single family residential homes with similar setbacks. And, you know, that's where we could get into design standards that we enforce.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's different between the duplex requirement versus the other middle housing types in that because it says in areas zoned for residential versus on every lot. So we might not be able to prohibit duplexes on every lot through a density requirement or a lot size standard. But we could say one of our siting standards for all the other middle housing types other than duplexes, when we're talking about allowing them in all the areas, it might be regulated by lot size or density.
Or the example in the webinar was you could, right now, duplexes are allowed on corner lots, so we could allow right now what they're floating before they have, you know, any official code writing is like allowing those other housing types on corner lots or restricting it to size.
Yeah, right.
Do you foresee an instance where we could end up not having a minimum lot size for a duplex siting or needing a back door for that if somebody wanted to build a duplex subdivision?
I would foresee potentially relying just purely on our density and not regulating lot size. I mean, I think that's a potential option. We could say you can do 1,000 square foot lots if you want to do row houses, mm-hmm. as long as whatever you do doesn't exceed our maximum density. So if it was our medium density residential zone, which I think we allow single family homes in our medium density.
We allow detached single family in all zones.
Even in our high density. Yeah.
I don't know how you would do that in high density.
So
and meet the it's not physically possible.
Everybody has a fishing a little ice fishing hut.
Yeah.
It's 3 stories tall.
But again, like I said, it's impossible once you count in lot frontage requirements and the setbacks and all this other stuff and height limitations. You create this buildable envelope. It's really difficult to meet our
density. Yeah, if you want a curb cut for a parking,
right,
for your driveway or for a garage.
So, but a lot of these ideas or these topics we're talking about right now are, in my mind, things that would slow down the code update process in trying to fully implement this legislation now. So trying to figure out these siting and design standards for allowing all the middle housing types in all of our residential areas is in my mind, the bigger lift for the code update that we weren't initially anticipating. I mean, we were anticipating implementing our existing comprehensive plan policies, mm-hmm. making it easier to do development, making it much clearer and easier to use. But this element of now in every single family neighborhood being required to allow all these middle housing types is a whole nother step above what we were originally contemplating. Because there's going to be a lot of these questions on, is it just fourplexes on corner lots now instead of duplexes on corner lots? And duplexes everywhere, and do the duplexes, they might look exactly like a single family home, but are there design elements that we want to get into?
Yeah, we're going to end up in the same spot. Like, honestly, I could, like, if we could define the whole thing strictly by a density thing with the community mm-hmm. behind, and, you know, and just open the sort of floodgates to actual types,
mm-hmm.
I would be good with that,
right.
Because I think the real strength of the development code comes from a certain amount of clarity as far and easy to understand and easy to use, right? Like if we had there's housing types that we would think of as middle that aren't specifically on this list,
right.
And there's housing types people haven't even come up with yet. So I almost would want to go just a little bit further beyond that if we can get, like, if you meet the density and you meet building code standards, right? So it's safe to live in. You know, I think I'm good.
Yeah. And like, and a key piece of what I heard you just say is if we can get the community behind it.
I know. Yeah.
You know, because that's a whole nother thing. I mean, are the community, these existing neighborhoods where they maybe don't have CC&Rs, that now they have the, I mean, we've already opened the door a little bit with allowing ADUs everywhere, right? And they haven't taken off completely, although they're starting to ramp up a little bit. And now it's like opening the door that much wider. It's a, all right, now it's not just ADUs, it's duplexes everywhere. It doesn't have to be limited in size.
So effectively, a lot of the applications for ADUs are just people creating duplexes and using the way the code is set up for attached ADUs to really create a duplex. Right. There's very little difference between a lot of those applications that we're seeing.
It's just a size. They're limited to 800 square feet. Okay. One guy is, just came in, they're putting a manufactured home in as an ADU, and it's like a 1,200 square foot manufactured home, and he's having to have them customize, like shrink it down to the 800, like cut the end off, you know, and make it maximum 800 square feet.
But for like attached units, what's the difference in neighborhood impact? I mean, this is my thought, between an 800 square foot side attached to 1,000 square foot versus I mean, what's that extra 200?
Honestly, some of it's traffic.
I think it's some sort of tangible governor as far as how fast this could go.
And an interesting piece of the legislation, I'm going to jump ahead again too, and I'm not even sure if I highlighted this part, but it talks about, so in making changes to our codes and comprehensive plan to implement this legislation, we don't have to consider transportation impacts. So basically they're saying we have to increase the density and they want us to ignore any impacts from increasing the density to our transportation system. It says we get to ignore the TPR.
We will have to take all of that into account the next time we update our transportation system plan, however, though, I think that's where we get more hit. But ours is, I mean, we're at least lucky that it's newer.
Yep.
So we're about a 2014 one to 2035.
It's going
to
be interesting.
So we've got time to see how things shake out before we're in that process.
I know there's a lot of questions. Sure. I'm going to keep rifling through really quick and hopefully get to a point where then we can talk about a little more broader direction on what we think, how we should approach it is really. So I'm going to turn to the bottom of page 2 is a large highlighted section that this talks about getting an, so there's deadlines for us to do all these things, to make our code changes. There's a and as Christina mentioned a few minutes ago, we're out in front of the state a little bit already in that we're underway with our code update and contemplating some of this already. We have talked internally in casual conversations about, do we stay out in front of the state? And this legislation requires the state, DLCD, to develop a model code for how to implement this that then cities can take and adopt wholesale if they want. It's like, okay, we're not going to figure it out. We'll take how the state said and a model to do it, and we'll just do that. Well, there's some thought that we could develop the code that becomes the model, or we do it ahead of that and maybe don't get it 100% right and have to kind of come back and fix it later. Or we don't do it at all and wait for the model code and come back and try and implement all this stuff at a later date after we've potentially already adopted some of our residential code update.
So this is where I have a comment. So we have this timeline. We have, like, we have to adopt this by June 30th, 2022, and the model code has not been created yet. They just hired somebody to create it, so it's going to be a while, and then there will be limited funding from the DLCD for, you know, cities to hire consultants to help figure out this personalized community vision to implement this. And then if we don't have the code in place by the deadline, then we automatically have the DLCD's version, which I think could make the community feel as if, like, their voice doesn't matter and it's like state control and didn't work with them to create a vision. So I think this right now is like an unprecedented opportunity that we just happen to be updating our development code as this happened. And we could totally just do this, use this extra time that we have while we're ahead to do some community visioning and have some design charrettes and open houses and hear what people want and figure out a way to and have Springfielders feel like they're having their community vision come through. Because, like, that year that we're going to have, year and a half after the model code comes out, like, that's a short amount of time in the planning world.
And so that's true. I mean, we have about 18 months from now till the state has to have their model code. And then we have about 18 months after they come out with their model code to decide, do we want to adopt their model code? Do we want to tweak it? Do we want to come up with our own? But you're right, we're already underway. My fear is that trying to do some of what I think Sophie talked about will, I mean, I already have said this before, we're on a very tight timeline to do our code update, the 3-year timeline. Trying to kind of incorporate all of this now will slow down that timeline. There's no question in my mind about that. It's going to take longer to do this extra work if that's the direction we want to go.
One thing I think that's unknown is that the law gives us, it requires us to adopt things by those dates, but it doesn't really give direction about if we adopt other amendments after it's effective and before the deadline. Are those amendments remandable or appealable if they don't comply, if they don't meet those requirements? So I think that's a risk that we take in not addressing it, but making a wholesale update. So I think there's...
So what's the enforcement mechanism? Somebody would basically...
Somebody could appeal us to LUBA.
Yes.
And LUBA would say, this is law, and you made changes. And you made changes that address these areas. Go back and redo it.
There's like an enforcement order, probably, through LCDC.
I don't think that they would do an enforcement. I think this, you have it, you shall do it by this date, means LCDC would not take enforcement action. But if we are adopting code after the effective date, proactively adopting, because that's what we're doing,
right.
And we adopt code that does not meet the requirement that you allow a duplex on each lot,
right.
Does not provide for those middle housing types, then I think that there could be an appeal similar to what Eugene's going through now, where they've appealed the accessory dwelling unit standards that Eugene adopted and said you didn't meet all the requirements.
But they were way beyond the date anyway.
They were.
I mean, if we're not beyond the date yet, they can't appeal us and tell us we haven't done it yet because we're not required to have done it.
Well, so the date, so that's what I'm saying, is the date for Section 3 to say when we shall do it is June 20th, 2022.
Right.
But the date that Section 2, with all those requirements, becomes effective is a lot earlier. So we're in this, there's an interim period where these amendments are all effective, which means that they, in theory, apply to actions by the city, but they're saying you don't have to take any action until 18 months from then.
Yeah.
So the question is, if we are independently taking action that we don't have to take, but we're taking it,
right.
Do these apply to us?
Yeah.
And I don't know that there's an answer one way or the other, but I could definitely, because other people have made similar arguments, if there's someone interested and pushing the envelope, we could be in that, in a cut in between.
So we can figure that answer out.
It's a risk to delaying action,
right.
I think. I don't know that it's a major risk or a insurmountable risk. It's just one of the risks.
Is it a risk to, you know, a plan amendment zone change type of action or to a different code rewrite, or is it a risk at the permit counter?
I don't think that it's a risk. I think it's a defensible risk at the permit counter because they've given us time to implement. I think it's a risk at the code amendment level.
When we are affirmatively amending
our code, and we are affirmatively amending it at a time in which this statute applies, but we haven't yet been directed to make that change. So that's where I think the uncertainty comes out.
Okay.
I don't know why we can't get anything built around here.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the day after this bill passed, basically, we had people coming into our front counter asking, can I build a duplex now?
Mm-hmm.
We're like, no, we have 3 years to implement this thing.
And it hasn't even been signed yet. So.
Yeah.
And my guess is that there's, and tell me if I'm reading this right, there's implications in this that people, like, that in the short session that they may have to, assuming it gets signed, take up to kind of correct and clean up.
Potentially.
And did you guys know why there's the requirement for the model code? Representative Fahey, as I understand it, was very upset with Eugene not taking care of business about the ADUs.
Yeah.
And so now all zoning stuff is going to come down with the, you get to enforce this.
It will be directly applicable if you don't do it.
Yeah.
because the ADUs, they came out with a guidance document that was just that. It was guidance, but not directly.
So
the guidance document didn't go through any formal process that their model rules would go through to get input from people, too. So it was, it was, on the one hand, not enforceable, and on the other hand, not vetted.
So really, our two directions are we can keep going, right, keep doing what we're doing, try to sort of stick the landing and be compliant with the rules, understanding that there's some risk as this develops.
Yeah.
That we may have to take a step back and kind of tweak what's going on, right? Or we wait for the model code to come out.
Yeah, I mean, I came up with three potential options. Okay. One was slow down the residential phase, maybe kind of skip over it, and then come back to it when we have more guidance on the model code and try and fully implement the legislative changes. The other one, well, actually, so that was kind of two combined. So we, let me say it this way. One would be to fully implement the legislative changes now, try and be ahead of this thing, and that would slow down the process that we're underway with. The other would be not try and fully implement these changes at all and just keep on our path, and then understanding that we'll have to come back and basically revisit it or redo our residential piece that we adopt to implement all the changes. And the middle of the ground one was just stop the residential phase, continue on with our commercial industrial, wait for some of the statewide, the model code, the direction, and then start up the residential phase again later. Those are kind of the three options I came up with.
So how would stopping the residential phase affect the TAC?
Well, the TAC would, so right now we're already, we have been fairly unsuccessful in recruiting a TAC for our commercial industrial phase. So, and it's been difficult over the summer already to schedule a next residential TAC meeting. I think I've landed on an August 16th date, so is that 2 weeks from tomorrow, I think, to hold our next TAC meeting. I intend to talk to them about that group rolling over as continuing on as a TAC for the commercial industrial phase. I know there's some interest. The two applicants we've received so far for our commercial industrial TAC are TAC members on the residential TAC. I know there are some members of that group that are very specifically interested in housing and may not be interested in commercial industrial, so it might be kind of a subgroup or a sub-TAC. So we're still trying to figure out that dynamic. But if we completely stopped the residential phase right now, I think then we would essentially stop those residential TAC meetings at this point.
And potentially lose TAC members?
Yeah. It would kind of have, we'd have to gear up and kind of restart residential again later once we got better direction on how we're trying to going to fully implement the new legislation.
Is there a path through this that would not require iterations? I'm not really hearing that there is, even with the model code. What? Maybe there's cleanup in the short session. Is there any potential for case law on this? Luba's going to hear things, nuances, no?
Really, I would say there's little opportunity for case law before the model code comes out and before those timelines for adoption start to hit, because I would be surprised if other local governments really right now start doing a lot of code amendments. We've already started a process, but I don't know that there's really other jurisdictions out there that are doing this work, and so I would be surprised if there's anything to sort of test that.
One thing I wanted to jump to quick before we, it could be part of the conversation. So the piece I was starting to point to on the bottom of page 2 has to do with extensions. So part of the legislation allows us to request an extension to fully implementing this. It requires us to do a study. It's based on infrastructure capacity. One thing I want to point out, it's that subsection 2 under section 4 says an extension under the section may be applied only to specific areas, and then it goes on to talk about identified infrastructure deficiencies. It was interesting to me in the webinar we attended. It was the OAPA, the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, and the representative from DLCD was there. So the money, to DLCD that came along with these two bills, they presented these numbers in that webinar last week. So just to give some context, DLCD's two-year budget is a $22 million budget. The new money they receive with these two bills, 2001, 2003, was $6.5 million. So is that about a third of their total two-year budget? They got an additional to implement these two bills. They so 4.5 of that 6.5 million is for technical assistance, and that's between the two bills. 3.5 million from House Bill 2001, which again I think is the primary one, and another million for House Bill 2003. So that leaves about 2 million they're going to hire 7 FTE with and do contracting and other stuff. But the question that was interesting to me that was posed by the DLCD rep was, they're trying to figure out internally at DLCD how much of the $3.5 million in technical assistance for House Bill 2001 should be used to help cities do the infrastructure studies to request the extensions.
The law states that the department shall prioritize technical assistance to cities or counties with limited planning staff or that commit to implementation earlier than the date required under Section 3.1, which I think precludes, it would only be for those entities that have limited planning staff, because the state law doesn't let them prioritize money to people that are requesting interventions.
It doesn't?
No, unless it's very limited planning staff, and they're somehow going to use that piece of it.
And where is that language?
The very last
16,
part of 15.
So anyway, I thought it was interesting they were even talking about that. And again, we haven't fully dissected this, so I don't know whether they're going to provide technical assistance to do these infrastructure studies or not. It sounds like they possibly can't provide money. My sense, we received the technical assistance grant to do this original housing audit, the clear and objective housing audit that we just completed. And we didn't fully fit the criteria for a city that was prioritized to receive that technical assistance. So a lot of it is figuring out, how much demand there is and where the money can go and who can qualify for it. A lot of small cities probably won't even try and do this, and they'll just take the model code once they develop it and implement it directly, so they don't even have to think about it. I mean, a lot of small cities don't have even a planner. It's the city clerk that does the planning for a town, around the whole state, that they don't do a lot of growth or anything.
So, and I think my instinct is, right, listening to what the commercial portion of it is, and you've got the committee here, is to sort of keep going in a way that sort of try to minimize how much we have to iterate going in, right? Like, I understand we may have to pick up the code, look at it, dust it off again, and go, okay, does it comply with state law?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, help me understand the risk a little bit. Like, is there a chance that, like, how big is the risk that we get to the end of it, we implement our code rewrite, and we find out that we have to redo the whole thing? Or is it just, hey, there's a good chance we have to take a week or so and, go back through and tweak a few things just to make sure, kind of dial it in?
And in my mind, one piece of the risk is, and it's similar to how Eugene got called out on their ADU mm-hmm. provisions, I think we would have to be appealed by somebody that we were applying the new code to. Mm-hmm. And they said, we don't think you're consistent with state law, and appeal us to LUBA, and LUBA remands us and says, yeah, they're right, you're not consistent. So I don't think it would be until that point that where the risk would arise.
So is that less risk?
So we're at risk right now today with our existing code, because we don't have clear and objective standards for housing today, and we haven't gotten appealed by anybody, and nobody's even challenged us on a individual project to say, you can't apply these standards to me because they're not clear and objective, and that's their right to do today.
Right, I think this is what you're describing, what I would feel like is like a
I don't know, bigger than a bread box, maybe a car size, not an ocean liner size risk, right? Like it's.
I think the biggest risk that we have of our code at all is somebody calling us unclear and objective, because it's very well established case law. Our code, we have an audit that shows our code is very out of line with it. People raise it all the time. And so I think the biggest risk of not doing anything is that we have a not clear and objective code sitting out there for longer. I think the risk that we're going to adopt something in our code rewrite that doesn't comply with what we find out the state law, DLEC thinks the state law means later, I think that's a lower risk, but it depends on how far we push the envelope. So if we are trying to walk back the extent of what the legislation could do in Springfield, and we're trying to be very conservative in what types of new development we would allow, that risk is greater. If we're being very, if the council decides and the commission, planning commission and governance team decide that we want to be very permissive and we want to really allow a lot of things, then that risk is very low, in my opinion.
So reading the section, a local government that has not acted within the time provided under subsection 1 of this section shall directly apply the model ordinance developed by the commission under subsection 2 until the local government acts as described in subsection 1. Mm-hmm. So if we go for it, mm-hmm. And then it turns out it's challenged, if we had acted, then there's no chance that they make us use the model code. Like, we would just have to adjust the code that we wrote.
So what would happen? Let's walk
through. Sorry, that was not
so
very clear.
So we update our code, and we adopt new residential standards, and we think we've met House Bill 2001, because that's what we've done. Like Mark was saying, somebody comes in for a development application, and we rarely deny things in Springfield, so we put conditions of approval on it. And the person doesn't like those conditions, and we're not able to work it out, so they appeal. And on the appeal, they're going to say they could say a number of things. One thing they could say is it doesn't meet the requirements in House Bill 2001, and therefore you can't apply them to me. Or they could say your underlying code adoption doesn't meet the requirements of 2001, and you should have applied the model code to my development. I don't know how likely someone is going to be, because our code's likely to be a lot different than the model code if we go first.
It's likely to be more permissive.
Yeah, just based on the community and the direction we've just got so far, I think that's true. So I think the likelihood someone would come in and say, you should have applied, your code was deficient, you should have applied the model code to me because you didn't act within the meaning of the statute, that risk is probably very low. It's more likely going to be something around, you have an obligation as a city to allow a duplex on each lot, and this conditioning this doesn't means that you're not allowing it. Okay, and so those types of very specific towards the statute arguments, rather than somebody's going to appeal and LUBA is going to say, no, you have to start doing the model code.
Okay, so the only way we would have to implement the model code is if we don't adopt anything before June 30th, 2022.
We don't adopt anything that we think meets the... So we could adopt code, but that doesn't even try to do any of this stuff.
Okay.
So I think we would have to apply.
In the ordinance, adopting whatever changes we come up with, if we think we're trying to do it to adopt, to be in compliance with this, would we say in the ordinance,
yes,
this,
yes,
is to
whereas implement, this law requires us to do this, whereas blah, 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 blah.
Even
and
though
that's
we're
the
first
history,
and we don't know if it meets the model code. I mean,
it's not a requirement that the law does not require us to meet the same standards as in the model code.
Right.
The model code will be one way to meet the state law requirements, but there will be lots of other ways to do that as well. So,
and luckily we have good lawyers. Okay, so if we just kind of go for it, and maybe Grace, can you help us think through this? Like, if we just like, or how big is the risk that, you know, we fundamentally change the real estate market here?
Well, I think, to be perfectly honest, I think with what I know, the state association is doing and hoping to do in the short session, I think, and also combining what you had mentioned about allowing our community, those that have a vested interest, to have a say, I think that's where it's going to impact the most. That's not really answering your question. Just trying to figure out the people that I've talked with, and I know that, how do I say this to make it seem friendly, a lot of people that are homeowners
they're nervous that this code, this new House Bill 2001, is already going to change the dynamic of their neighborhood. So whether we do that and we implement what we interpret it to be, or we wait for the state to come down and say, here's a model code and this is what you need it to be, that may not fit the feel of our community. Either way, there's going to be people upset. There's people, home values are going to change. Potential, I should say. I don't have a crystal ball, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I think that if we have the opportunity, just my opinion, if we have the opportunity to have some sort of code that we all know Springfield and we know what it would look like and feel like for us, and if we have the opportunity to take that and allow our community to be involved in that process and get ahead of it, it shows that we are more friendly to our community.
Yeah.
That hopefully answers a little bit.
It's only a tough question to, you know, wrap your head around.
Yeah. I have a little bit of input there. So I've been looking, I was wondering, like, how will this change, like, the dynamic of our community? And I think every community will be different, especially with the different codes they'll be adopting. But it's going to, from what I understand so far with neighborhoods that have upzoned, an example is in Portland, it's a slow change. Mm-hmm. Bank financing right now is completely structured around financing single family homes. So that's one of the barriers that has been identified with community organizing within the last few years for like what's preventing us from building it now. And a lot of it is like, can't get loans to do it. And then we also have Minneapolis to look at for, you know, what their standards are doing. But I think also something that I am going to focus on throughout this time is separating homeownership from single family homes, because there are a lot of renters that occupy single family homes. I lived in single family homes for the last 4 years with four other girls in them. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that somebody is going to be owning the home and changing the character of the neighborhood when there's no longer single family homes, because there's a heck of a lot more renters out there than we know, and I'm one of them, and I want to feel like I'm wanted in the community. You know, I feel like I contribute to the community. I'm here now volunteering my time. So really changing how we talk about it and being intentional about how we talk about it, but it's going to be, I just have a feeling it's going to be pretty slow. I think some developers will get excited and jump out, but yeah, like there's a lot of other stuff to change besides the development code. Financing is like the main one.
I tend to agree with you too, because in a substantially built environment, somebody's got to be willing to take the risk to demo the equity they have and get a loan and build a new product.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the worst case, fear force the city to allow them to do that. So that's a lot of lifting. I mean, a lot of lifting.
Yeah, so, like, I think we go for it.
It's the fear that's kind of the bigger hurdle. I mean, people are scared of the quick change,
right,
rather than the reality that it will probably be slow. It's the perceived, you know, the world, the sky is falling, and now.
Yeah, but I think we keep going, no matter what. But I think at the end of the day, right, like, fear drives a lot of where the resistance for development comes from. And, you know, this community has a good track record of sort of working its way through it, through, you know, some sort of process. So they'll get there.
So when you say keep going, do you mean keep going with residential and try and fully implement to the, with,
yeah,
that's our intent.
Mm-hmm.
And so acknowledging that it may slow down the residential piece of the project?
Well, you don't have a commercial team, you don't have a commercial tech to rely on, right? So, you know, you arguably have, you know, some time. I think, you know, you keep going at the same track that, you know, you are, and get as far as we can. If we have to come back and look at it again, then we'll come back and look at it again.
And so, like, head nod wise, I mean, is,
yeah,
that,
I stand behind him on that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you three are in agreement.
I think it's really crucial right now, especially, mm-hmm, as, you know, right now where the economy is, not just financially, but we are in a housing crisis. And I will always speak to home ownership just because that's what I know.
Yeah.
But also in the rental market, you know, we might have a big shift. You know, we have a lot of shift happening in different political offices. I have a lot of clients that are actually moving out of state because they're not happy with how it's happening. And there's a lot of investors that are moving, and so we might see that shift. But I think for us to do it right now, residential real estate, whether that's owning or renting, is the hot topic right now. And I think that, that we need to stay on top of that.
And that's great. I'll take that direction. Do you think, and I'm mostly asking Sean because you're on the council, but including you on the governance team, but at some point should I come back to the whole council and present this idea that it's a little bit of change in our plan and will likely take longer? Or how to adjust that? Wait until we are delayed, or?
Well, I think about it two ways. One of them would be like when you really think about the timeline itself, mm-hmm. how long is it going to actually impact the timeline? Because if, you know, on a crazy day, if you're talking about it's going to add 4 years, right, that's a different conversation than if it's going to add 24 hours, right?
Right, sure.
I don't know that you need to, like, I would maybe, and once you know that, maybe slip it back into a communication packet memo and just say, hey, like, here's a slight adjustment, you know, as far as how we're working, and here's the reason why we're sort of doing it. And then, you know, you have, like, a quarterly meeting with us, and
right.
we can talk about it.
Okay.
Because I don't know that, like, I think it's that informed versus that we need to have a discussion about it level.
Right.
Like, give it to them, because they're definitely going to think about it.
I think the biggest lift on this part of the project is still going to be the clear and objective element of it.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah. Ironically, clear and objective is not going to make the code less confusing, shorter, or easier to understand.
But that's
a kind of a key challenge.
But I think that's the policy place we want to stick into, is that it's got, like, regulations are good as long as people understand what they're supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, some of the other things we've talked about, Mark, just moving to really a very user-friendly e-code model that's will jump back and forth sort of for you, or will extract everything you need after you. You know, the dream is to kind of have an H&R Block tax program where you never even see the forms, but you ask it the questions and it gives you what you need.
Yeah. The city is not anywhere remotely in the ability.
I know, that's why it's the dream, but yeah. I understand. But in terms of concept, it's kind of neat to think about. I want to build a house, you get back the code sections you need.
Yeah, I think that's a really good challenge to kind of put out there from an ability to do it, and I think that's where we sort of need to launch.
Yeah, not saying we can do it.
Yeah, even for big corporations, that's actually like a really tough lift. But like finding a way to make it easier for the average citizen to do it.
Yeah. We can dream.
Yeah.
But I think I want to jump off on that point like for a second. I think it's pretty clear when we talk to the council on a range of issues, right? There's an interest in, you know, codes and, like, the whole world's changing around us, right? And we don't, like, if we can kind of have a place that is more, I guess, open and inclusive to where all those new ideas sort of come from, like, you just hear it keep coming up at council about, okay, you know, suddenly this new business isn't permitted in this area because nobody ever conceived that it could exist, right? So, like, when we think about the housing place, I don't want to feel really limited by the middle housing that's listed specifically, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I would really like it to feel open enough that whatever that new thing is, it's more, it starts in, and then we have to take it out, versus mm-hmm. starting out, and then we have to take it in.
And, yeah, I agree. And I think even just saying, here's the density range, build whatever you want within that, I mean, kind of broad. We're not going to list these types. If some other creative housing type comes up that might fit still, you're saying don't specifically list so much that you prevent other things from happening. I hear that.
Yes, and I think you hear it in a range of topics and policy discussions at council.
And then if something everybody hates happens, then we'll have to come back and account for it, right? Okay. Is that, yeah. So be permissive at the outset.
Yep.
Great.
This is more a CCI perspective than a Planning Commission perspective. But
when you mentioned that people are moving and upset with how things are, like, people are scared. Like, this is a scary piece of legislation. Like, personally, I was really excited to see it go through, but that is not how my planning coworkers see it. I'm starting to learn. So it's scary. It can have, you know, different effects. It can have detrimental effects. I think a really great example that people point to all of the time locally is, you know, the really quick, dramatic change in the West University neighborhood, mm-hmm. from mostly single family homes to very large duplexes and triplexes and quadplexes. So I would really love to see like a listening session or a community conversation where we just like quell fears a little bit. A great example of that was the open house for the TSP code updates, where mm-hmm. it's like, here are the experts, ask us anything. Like, let's like have this conversation before it gets to planning commission and before it gets to council. Like, you know, have, this is going to be a community led process, and we have a fantastic TAC that is, you know, very can get into the weeds with the code language, but I know that people are already getting scared because there's headlines on newspapers that are like, right. Oregon banned single family homes. Like, we didn't ban single family homes. Like, they're not going anywhere. They are like,
all of you have to know.
Only building duplexes.
Yeah. I think this whole process has been so community oriented so far, which is wonderful. And yeah, like, let's set a precedent and invite people in and listen to them.
That's great feedback. And, you know, I know Eugene on their website did a FAQ specifically for House Bill 2001. We've held off in doing that. But I think your kind of comments lead us towards eventually doing something like that. And whether we combine an actual physical listening session also with some online tools for FAQs and providing feedback or asking questions, I think this could both be good ways of engaging the community.
So yesterday, I was up at the Oregon Association of Realtors executive session, and our governance director is going to be sending out materials for House Bill 2001, an FAQ, exactly uh-huh. what you're talking about.
Okay.
I'm happy to share that, and
that'd
you can
great.
Glean information from that if you wanted with the staff and see if there's something that you guys wanted to use.
Yeah, and you guys have a different perspective. I mean, getting different perspectives and kind of what some of the concerns or worries are, and just from different sectors of the market. And, you know, I keep our city blinders on, but the real estate part of it is clearly tied together, and so how we answer those questions or provide information, I think, is critical. So that would be great.
Yeah, and I know that it'll come from a perspective similar to yours, that you're excited about it because the Oregon Realtors actually stood behind it.
Okay, so they are excited about it in general.
In general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're at 4:00. We're 5 minutes after, so we've been exactly an hour from when we started. But I don't want to make sure nobody has any other commitments. But anything else we can talk about? Or, I mean, there's a lot we didn't get to, but you have the legislation in front of you. Which one? No, that's at the TAC.
Oh.
Yeah.
Could you maybe give us the Reader's Digest version about House Bill 2003?
Yeah, you know, it's a bit of a different animal because I would say there's not a lot of really intense planning changes that have to happen to enact it. My read of it is, actually, I take that back. I'm thinking of a different, it all kind of blurs together at some point. So this really has a lot to do with when we update our either UGB or our residential lands inventory. Let me make sure I'm reading. So this, a lot of it is going to be, and Sophie and I were talking a little bit at the beginning before the meeting. It looks like the state, and I forget which department, is it the housing department? They're going to be doing regional housing needs analysis. So I imagine they're going to take the Eugene Springfield MSA or whatever, the metro plan area, and say, for our metro region, what is the housing need? And it's going to be a lot more comprehensive in my mind from reading the legislation than typical housing needs analysis of yesteryear. were, and with a much stronger focus on the affordability components. For instance, both Eugene and Springfield just, well, neither one of us expanded our UGB for housing because we said we have enough inventory to meet the need, right? Well, part of the existing state law that we both did our analysis under contemplates affordability, but clearly there's an affordability issue in the Eugene Springfield area. I mean, the gap's not being met, right? Even though we both said we have enough inventory, and it's kind of more pure land inventory. So this changes how those analyses are done for the future. And it also requires, it kind of reinstitutes periodic review, which we haven't been subject to for some time. And it says, so the state is going to figure out a schedule for every city in Oregon that puts them on an 8-year cycle, that every 8 years we're going to have to be required to do these studies and keep a housing inventory that meets, you know, this economic stability, or how it balances. Let's see, what else is in here? Is there anything either of you want to add?
Well, kind of you covered the front part.
Yeah.
Regional housing needs analysis that lead to citywide housing needs analysis.
Yeah.
Analyses that lead to adopting a housing production strategy.
That's a good, yeah. That is.
Which...
Which I knew we were missing something.
Leads to a schedule provided by the state to identify lands for needed housing, and that might be a way to move beyond the current urban growth boundary. But it would still be boxed into production of needed housing.
So I think that may be where the question is, because I think we probably made a mistake by not expanding our residential lands, especially if there's still the Thurston Wildlife or Wilderness area, right? Because that was all single family homes in the plan before we changed the zoning. So, like, there's definitely a conversation there where I think part of the problems were missing land. And at the end of the day, right, affordability gets fixed when there's more doors out there and any of the planning side and, like, if we need to point where we have more doors, we'll be fine.
Part of this housing production strategy requires, you know, looking at certain tax incentives, and, you know, there's all kinds of a menu of things that they're going to want to incentivize. How can we? Because we could expand our UGB, you know, 10,000 acres, and we can't force people to develop. I mean, somebody might sit on their land or just not want to develop, or.
Entitling the land with infrastructure is really
expensive. Right.
Yeah. And that's the conversation that's missing, right? Like, in a hot economy, it's not like people are lining out, you know, down the street from the planning department. Right. There's something there. I don't know what it is, but...
And it's true. Infrastructure is a key piece. I mean, we're talking about that a little bit with North Gateway area for employment land, or Glenwood even. How do you provide the infrastructure for these areas? So... And can development pay for it itself? I mean, should growth pay for it? It's all the development as it happens and all those type of things.
It's a lot to ask of developers right now. Like, so if they find a piece of property, Springfield's annexation fee correlates with size. So the bigger the parcel is, you know, the bigger the development, the more expensive that is. And then if you want to partition it or subdivide it, that's another fee. And then it could be on an old county road, which then you have to bring up to standards, you know, and suddenly, like, this development's not going to pencil out. So that's where it's like, yeah, we could have all this land, or it can be on a slope, and then it's more expensive there, or, you know, extending the water line, or even bringing a water line down an old county road. So it is so expensive right now to build. And
construction costs are really high. We've heard that over and over. The construction costs are through the roof. And, you know, would expanding the UGB 5,000 acres bring down land values? I mean, I don't know, the market is at play, and I don't know how that...
Yeah, it's a much, I think, broader discussion, right? Because my understanding from a construction cost perspective, even if you had the 10,000 acres and Tom put up all the infrastructure for it, that we're missing the actual crews to actually build it, especially going in with the wildfire seasons and how bad they hit Northern California because it's siphoned off some of our skilled labor. Right? So, like, you just have this multiple layers of, like, hey, there's no infrastructure, but, like, we have nobody to build it, and we can't get a loan, and yada, yada, yada.
And I mean, I try and zoom out still too and think, okay, we're planning for the next 20 years. At some point in the next 20 years, we're going to have a recession of some sort again. You know, construction costs will likely go down. Unemployment will probably go up. You know, I mean, all these factors are at play. So at some point, there'll be a sweet spot again where development can happen and it will pencil out to do some sorts of development, whether it's multifamily or commercial again at some point or more single-family homes or whatever. I mean, there will be sweet spots to come when the development will be happening.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, we can identify those areas in our code that remove existing unnecessary barriers.
Right. So setting our code up now for the next 20 years, so it will be easier and more streamlined.
But if HB 2003 is the sort of only path towards a residential UGB expansion, and then there, because of this required housing production strategy, we somehow have to limit what those new houses at the fringe cost, either to rent or to buy, and that's, you know, the state essentially dictating what type of housing project to develop. That's not where the margin is. The margin is on bigger homes. Small lots, right?
Yeah.
So who then would develop that? And how much can the city afford to incentivize that type of development?
Well, and that's why, like, from a policy perspective, right, like, I don't care if it's a big door or a small door, right, like, if we build anything, it's good. If it's on the upper end, right, like, it gets people to move through the whole system.
Right. But it might be that we can't adopt a housing production strategy that has us expanding the UGB for the upper end. I mean, I don't know this because all this is brand new, but it's passed through my mind.
When we have legislative committee again, maybe we'll bring it up and maybe talk to the realtors and try to get on the same page because like we need to be sort of talking through this right now, right? Like, because the other thing I heard when they'd done the pilot programs for affordable housing is when you incorporated the 50 acres or whatever it is, it literally had to be those 50 acres. You couldn't even do an offset to say.
Couldn't move it around.
Yeah. Right, so it gets too structured.
Well, you know what's interesting about something that you brought up, and well, combination, is, you know, the conversation is the missing middle, the middle housing. But it's not just the middle housing that's having that crunch right now. The upper-end homes, they're having that crunch. And you had alluded to, you know, if you have those upper-end homes for these families to move into, to move up to, there's a lot of families that are doing multi-generational living to where if they're moving out of these other homes that maybe our first-time home buyer can now afford, or someone can have a second family or second home as an investor home to where they can have it be a rental. So we focus a lot on the workforce housing and not, in my opinion, enough on all housing equally. And that's what we're seeing is the downfall. It's the snowball effect.
I've even heard at the upper end of the market, there's no choice either. I mean, if you spend $500,000 or $750,000 on a house, you can really only buy a giant house on an individual lot. There's no variety of a nice townhome or a condo. I mean, Eugene has a little bit, but essentially there's no variety in Spring. You can't go buy a $500,000 townhome or condo.
Anecdotally, my stepdad was a city councilor, needed to downsize the obligations that went along with their property, could not find a place to move in Springfield, and moved to Eugene because it was the only option that they could find, and lost a city council position.
Because they don't want,
because for quality of life reasons and other reasons, they needed to not have so much property.
Yeah, they don't want a yard. They want to lock the door and go away for 2 months and not have to worry about anything.
I would be really good at being retired.
I've heard with the condos.
Any details, any dissent on that?
I've heard with the condos and the townhomes, also anecdotally, but I, as an intern for Eugene last year, I went around and interviewed 13 local developers and architects asking about barriers in the code to building missing middle housing. And we didn't talk about the code. We talked about financing. And something that comes into play with townhomes and condos are that they're incredibly hard to insure because HOAs can then sue the developer later on. So developers don't like to get involved in it. So that's like, there's all these weird like exterior factors, but you know, I was working in Albany for a little bit and they're building quite expensive townhomes and condos right now by the river.
That was brought up by Hayden Homes as well.
I wonder where that is.
And we flagged it for a legislative committee discussion. You know, I mean, legislate back, right? See what we can do to lift some of those HOA risk burdens to incentivize or to, you know, make clear the path a little bit for more absorption of that type of product.
A lot of pieces to the puzzle. Yeah.
So I've made a few mistakes. Okay, I made a lot of mistakes in my life, and one of them was not moving heaven and earth to buy into the Tate when it was $245,000 to do so.
And now are they like 700 or something?
Five.
Double.
480. I don't know.
And I mean, there hasn't been a whole, I mean, you would think as popular as the Tate has been, that there would be more of those kind of developments happening.
Well, I think she underwrote the risk.
Oh, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. But it, anyway, yeah. I don't know. So is that it? Thank you for your time. I'll look for more meeting invites and we'll schedule more of these, but this has been good feedback. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Great conversation.
This project just became.
So it was like, you know,
gotta solve it for
smaller,
those
but luxury finishes. Kind of condo, no upkeep.